Grab your favorite mug and fill it up with your favorite blend, because we're getting ready to sit down and talk about Southwest Florida real estate. Cottrell Title and Escrow presents The Closing Experience, real estate talk over a cup of coffee. What are my closing fees going to be? Should I rent or should I finally purchase? Why do I have to send all of these documents to get a mortgage? The real estate process doesn't have to be frustrating. Let our experts at Cottrell Title and Escrow help make buying or selling real estate a dream. Here to answer all of your questions, our host, managing partner of Cottrell Title and Escrow, James Schlimmer.
Okay, everybody, it's 12 noon. It's Tuesday. It's time for Cottrell Title and Escrow's webinar series with the lovely attorneys of Grant Cottrell Miller Myers. As you can see here, we have the lovely Aaron Miller Myers and Mr. Justin Cottrell.
Good afternoon.
Now, a couple weeks ago, we did something. We stepped outside of our comfort zone, and we did a Q&A, asked the attorney regarding the NAHBWAR contract. The questions were fantastic. I'd imagine the folks that are part of this, you can actually go back and watch the webinar. You can listen to the podcast of that. But by popular demand, we needed to do a Q&A, ask the attorney FARBAR.
Yay.
So here we are. We've got some lovely attorneys. And can I come out of the gate with a question, or...
Please. And I just realized I don't have a pen, nothing to twirl. So I will just fidget.
Do we need to do any disclaimers, or is there anything that we should do the right way to cover? Do you want to do a disclaimer?
Yes.
Go
this
ahead.
Is general advice based on hypotheticals, sometimes real life hypothetical events. If your client has legal counsel, please always consult with your client's attorney before using any of the hypothetical advice that we might provide today. So our goal here is to answer your questions about the FARBAR sales contracts, maybe the FARBAR as a sales contracts. And if you have any questions that stump us, which is possible, you are welcome to send us an email with that question. We'll follow up with you and we'll get the answer for you.
And just so you know, if you're new to the webinars there, right at the bottom of your screen, there's a Q&A button. Feel free to click the Q&A button. You can type in your question. Obviously, I'm here moderating. I can get them over to the attorneys and we can get that answered. Feel free to use the chat feature in here if you'd like as well. And we can kind of take it from there. But we do have our first question. We're going to come in hot. Here we go.
Let's do it.
All right. If time for acceptance has passed, what issues, if any, exist if seller either accepts or counters?
So you're saying time for acceptance of the sales contract has passed.
Acceptance of the offer, I'm saying,
Yep. And your deal is dead in the water. Unless, so whoever sent the last counter offer would be treated as a counter. So you will not have a fully executed contract until the other party also initials and dates and signs that contract. But I like a ratification. So to me, that's an easy way to clean up the issue. So if buyer sends an offer, it expires, seller responds. They want to accept everything that the buyer submitted in their offer, but they realize that they are responding after the counteroffer period or after the offer of acceptance period. There are two ways you can handle it. Either have the seller go ahead and change the date of offer acceptance, and the buyer would thereafter initials, so the seller's acceptance would be a counter offer. Buyer also initials next to that change. That doesn't usually happen, but the alternative is to have a ratification of contract. Buyer and seller hereby agree that this particular sales contract was executed after the offer acceptance period. Buyer and seller agree to move forward and clarify that the effective date shall be X. So the buyers or seller are agreeing as to the effective date.
Sure, absolutely. So yeah, and the ramifications really is that the person who thinks they're accepting the offer after that date is actually making an offer to the person who extended the offer before. So that's treated as an offer. Unless it's accepted, we don't have a contract. Hence Aaron's suggestion that we have a ratification, that everybody agrees that this is a contract. I think the next part of that question, though, is what happens if we just have buyer makes an offer, that offer expires, let's just say, on the 10th at midnight, and then on the 11th, this seller goes ahead and signs everything, agreeing to that, which would technically be a counteroffer, but all the parties continue to move forward without any type of ratifications. Are we under contract? Are we not? Pursuant to the terms of the contract, we're not. We'd have to get into equitable principles on whether or not that the parties, you know, essentially did anything in their detriment moving forward with reliance that the idea is that if everybody's treating this as a contract and everybody's moving forward as if it's a contract, could one party later then say, no, you know what, we're not under contract because technically you never signed under this date, and there's equitable principles that would allow a party to say we are under contract and that, but we don't want to deal with equitable principles. We want to deal with what certainty. The contract says in absolute certainties. Hence the idea of let's put a ratification together that all parties agree that we are now under contract, even though pursuant to the terms, it's not necessarily accurate.
Yes. Which brings us to another question that someone had emailed in, actually. How do we figure out the effective date of a sales contract in Farberland? Besides someone saying in a ratification to contract, the parties agree that the effective date is October 15th. How do we figure out what the effective date is? So it's the bottom of page one of our sales contract in paragraph three. So that's the second part of the time for acceptance of offer and counteroffer and the effective date. And it is the date that the last one of the parties signs. So buyer signs, initials, dates, seller signs, initials and dates. And the contract is delivered to the other party. So this is where it gets a little bit tricky. So we as closing agents don't always know when that contract was delivered over to the other party. So let's say that the seller signed the buyer's offer. They think they have a fully executed contract, but the agent is out of town for a few days and doesn't sure. get that executed contract over to the buyer for 3 days. And let's say that that offer expired in that time period. Well, you don't actually have a fully executed contract with a date that the parties can determine as the effective date, because
and the reason this is important because so many dates are based off that effective date,
right.
You know, whether it's their contingency periods or different things like that. So that's often very challenging to figure that out.
So for practical purposes, closing agents use the date, the last date next to the initials or signatures of the party who signed the contract, unless the agents who send us over the contract say, listen, they went back and forth for a number of days. We understand that the last initials were not dated, but it was initialed and delivered on X date. And then we would probably still suggest doing a ratification of contract just to confirm. But that at least lets us know when we calculate all the deadlines and timelines, we're using the same date that the buyers and sellers are thinking is their effective date.
Yep. And when Aaron talks about a ratification, what we're really talking about is a document that just adds clarity to that, that everybody agrees right now that this contract was executed on these days. This was the term. This was the effective date. So everybody can move forward and there's no issues arguing between a day or two moving on. And as anybody who's listened to these will know, we love clarity. That's the aim here. We want clarity. We don't want any issues. We don't want to be arguing about any uncertainties as we're moving down the road to closing. We want absolute certainty. So yeah. That's a goal.
We got a question.
All right.
Everybody's excited. If the finance contingency is passed and the lender gets the appraisal that is insufficient for loan approval, does the buyer deposit go back to the buyer? It's essentially the question.
Yes. So we look at paragraph 8 of the financing contingency, and there's recently a case about this exact same issue. So yes, if the buyer applies for financing and let's say assume that they get loan approval based on the financing terms in paragraph 8 of the contract. So the purchase price, the loan amount of that they are applying for, written in the contract, whether it's FHA, VA, conventional financing, whatever terms that they set forth in their contract, if they are received, let's say, loan approval or they went beyond the loan approval date, and then the lender will not close a transaction because the appraisal is insufficient to meet the approval terms, then yes, there is an out for the buyer. So we're looking in paragraph 8. I can point out the subparagraph. It is the exception. Subparagraph 7 of paragraph 8. So if loan approval has been obtained, which we know buyers received loan approval from their lender or deemed to have been obtained, meaning they did not, maybe they waived the financing contingency or they just let that loan approval period pass.
Expired. Which is what's in the question here. So it just passed, which means it's deemed waived. Yep.
Deemed waived and the buyer fails to close the contract, then the deposit will be paid to the seller unless one of these three exceptions apply. One of the exceptions is if the seller defaults. The other is a property-related condition due to the loan approval. Or number three, appraisal of the property obtained by the buyer's lender is insufficient to meet the terms of the loan approval. in which event the buyer receives the return of their deposit. Where some buyers get in trouble and they may not be able to use this provision to be able to receive a return of their deposit is they say on the contract that they want $100,000 financing at 5% interest. They apply for $300,000 financing at 2% interest, and therefore they can't say, as in the Font case, they can't say that they were denied financing upon the terms of the loan approval in the contract.
Sure.
Yeah.
Which, so, and when we talk about finance contingencies in the FAR bar land here, I like to really refer it to as a financing due diligence period, not so much a contingency, because when that time period expires, buyer generally cannot terminate the contract and receive their deposit in the event they're not able to obtain financing. This is the exception to that rule. If they're not able to obtain financing because the appraisal didn't come in pursuant to the terms of the financing in the contract itself, then yes, they are able to get an out on that. And this would be the exception to the idea that this is not a contingency, but a due diligence period.
As an aside, the FAR bar committee who prepares this contract, the Joint Committee of Attorneys and Realtors who prepare the FAR bar contract, they are looking into this as a result of the LaFont case. The question is whether it makes sense to include this exception for appraisals or not.
And the idea being that the buyer the thought is that the buyer should be responsible for getting their appraisal, done prior to the expiration of the finance contingency date. Therefore, if they get the appraisal back and it doesn't appraise, they can terminate at that point. They don't need to wait till the expiration of that date to terminate. So that's the thought behind it. We don't know how they're going to end up changing it if they do, but that's the idea.
We got another question.
All right.
All right. If deposits aren't made on a timely basis, what's a timely basis? I don't know, but I'll let you go there. On a timely basis, does the seller have the right to cancel or terminate the contract?
Well, pursuant to the terms of the contract is if the deposits are not made pursuant to the terms of the contract, absolutely seller can terminate at that point and pursue all their remedies under the FAR bar contract. The remedies being that they're entitled to deposits with a capital D, which is defined as deposits contractually agreed to be made, both the initial and the additional, whether or not they have actually been made at that point. So for an example of this, you go under contract and let's just say it's $1 million place and the buyers agree to put $10,000 down initially and $90,000 after 15 days. And then the buyer said, you know what, I don't think I want to purchase this property. And they just never put the $10,000 in that's due within 3 days. The seller can hold them in default and pursue the whole $100,000 of both the deposits as liquidated damages. And whether that's equitable or not is certainly up for debate, but that's black and white here on this contract, and there is no room really for, uncertainty there. It's pretty clear.
I had another question related to this topic where someone had asked if the seller gets to keep the deposit because the buyer defaulted under FAR bar land, can the agents receive a return of or a portion of that deposit? And the answer is yes. According to the sales contract, yes, and also likely according to your listing agreement that says, you know, if you're able to collect some funds due to a seller default,
sure,
they certainly can. So the contract says if the buyer default,
yes. Have you ever heard of brokers?
No, neither have I. One.
Neither have I, and it's probably based upon their business decision that brokers don't want to
exercise that right.
Yeah. They think maybe.
I think I've heard of a lawsuit regarding one, but I haven't heard of, as a matter of course, I think the idea is that the parties would like to get the full commission when the property closes and sells.
Whether buyer buys something else or the seller ends up selling to somebody else. Right.
Sure. If the deposit was made after the deadline, is that default deemed remedied?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it depends. Everything depends. I would suggest based upon, so we talked about this last week, what time of the essence actually means. If time is of the essence as to a term of a contract or a requirement under the contract, what essentially it means is that failure to comply with that term or complete that term is deemed a material default upon which the non-defaulting party can terminate. The case law, it goes a little bit back and forth, but I would suggest that there would need to be a notice of default and notice of termination prior to being able to actually terminate that contract. If that default is remedied prior to, well, if the default is remedied prior to that notice of default, I think that it'd be very difficult to argue that they were in default at that point and pursue that remedy. So I'm not sure whether I was clear in the answer. I don't think so. I don't think that there could be, they could claim default if the money's made, if the deposit's made prior to the non-defaulting party giving notice of the default and notice of termination of the contract. But the case law goes a little back and forth. It's not super clear on that.
If you have a buyer who is not going to make their deadline for submitting their deposit under a FARBAR contract, I would very highly suggest you go ahead and extend that deadline, get the parties to agree up front that, you know, that the buyer has an additional 2 days, especially during COVID. I feel like folks are more accommodating.
But more importantly, if you're representing the seller and that deposit's not made on the 10th and it's due on the 10th and the seller wants to get out of that contract, they need to give notice of termination on the 11th as soon as possible for them to protect all their rights.
Gotcha. Yeah. We got another question.
All right, let's take it.
So we've had this before in the on the neighbor one. So my hope is you can go into the difference between terminating and release of escrow funds. And the difference between the two there. But here's the question. Can verbiage be placed on the contract to ensure return of earnest money in the event of inspection issues or inability to obtain financing? There are cases where the seller refuses to sign the termination of contract and title company's hands are tied in releasing the funds.
We did talk about
that. That was a mouthful.
So when we talked about it last time, one of the questions that came up is, would I, as a title company, feel comfortable, and I think the example we used, let's just say it was the standard as-is contract with 15-day right of inspection, right to terminate, and we have a buyer who terminates on day 10, so clearly they're within their rights, and the seller does not sign a release of the funds. I think I would be comfortable with, as a title company, returning that money back to the buyer here, even without seller's release. Now, every title company and or law firm will have their different opinion on that. I think Aaron would be a little bit more conservative on there. Mm-hmm. And the remedy really is that the buyer has the right to, they're entitled to attorney's fees in the event that they brought an action on this. But so is there some, I guess the question is there something in the contract? The contract already states what should happen. Mm-hmm. It's really what we're dealing with here is a title company's reluctance to release funds without having all parties agree, mm-hmm. even though the contract is crystal clear. So where I'm getting at is there's nothing that you could put in the contract that could make it any more clear in most of these circumstances. And most title companies still will be reluctant to release it without agreement on both parties.
And brokers typically require a fully executed termination in their file. I imagine most brokers also require that fully executed termination in their file before they would allow the property to be listed again. And I think that that may be where the question was going. I think that there's a difference between a termination.
Yep.
The parties both agree that seller is no longer going to sell it to this buyer. Buyer is no longer going to purchase from the seller. But there's just a dispute as to who gets the deposit. I think that might be a different scenario. And so I think brokers should talk to their attorneys. But if brokers are willing to put the property back on the market once it's clear, either through the passage of the closing date, that the transaction's no longer going to be moving forward. Someone submitted a termination. The other party is no longer obligated because party A submitted a termination that you could list the property and move on with your life and then let the parties fight through their attorneys or hopefully come to an agreement about the release of the
Aren't there cases where, I mean, they don't have to agree on the termination. I mean, one party can terminate, right?
Depends on what the contract says.
So say, for instance, it's as is, it's day 10. The buyer does the buyer need the seller's agreement to terminate?
Absolutely not.
No, of course.
Because the contract states that they don't need to. They have the right to.
Yep.
But But sometimes it's not as clear as is to whether a buyer has a right to terminate for some reason. Some buyers think that they have rights to terminate that do not exist here in the contract.
Yep.
So then it would be a situation where there's a dispute as to whether the buyer had the right to do so or not. Hypothetically speaking, I may have heard of someone fighting a release of a deposit, though the HOA disclosure was clearly incorrect. The seller put his foot down and said, I disagree. I'm just not going to allow the release of the deposit back to the buyer. So in those instances, it escalates beyond the agents, beyond the brokers, and they each need to get their attorneys to battle it out to see who gets the deposit funds. But we talked about this last week. If you're talking about a $3,000 deposit and the escrow title company interpleads the funds to the court, meaning files a lawsuit, sends the funds to the court and says, listen, buyer A, seller B are fighting over this money. We had the money. We're now giving the money to the courts. They can battle it out. Leave us alone. The escrow title company will get their fees, attorney's fees paid and the filing costs paid out of that deposit. And then buyer and seller can fight over the funds. If there's only a $3,000 deposit, that doesn't leave much for the parties to fight over.
Nope. That's all gone.
Yeah.
So I guess the moral of that story is either A, ask for bigger deposit, or B, work it out yourself, because once attorneys get involved, there's just nothing left to fight over at the end of the day.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Another thing on deposits real quick. I've had some folks say my client wants to get 80% financing. They want to put 20% down. And so they put on page one of the contract, this is a bugaboo that I have. They put on page one of the contract, 20% down as deposits. 20% down does not, in your buyer's mind, does not mean they want to make 20% of the purchase price at risk if they
fail to close. Not necessarily. Yep.
Not necessarily.
Yep.
Maybe sometimes. That's not what they mean. So just because they're putting 20% down, make sure that your deposit is not that full 20% unless you have the conversation with your client. Hey, we're in Farber land. If you miss a deadline, potentially that whole 20% could be up for grabs.
Yes.
So use the balance to close line on the contract.
We got another question.
All right.
I wonder if that sounds so loud, by the way. Maybe I shouldn't scream. That's not a good idea. And I apologize if that is poor people's speakers. If repairs exceed 1.5% on the standard contract, mm-hmm. does the seller have the right to cancel the contract and opt to not move forward?
Not automatically. No. So we look at our standard paragraph 12, and I will give you the line for those of you following along with your sales contract. It is paragraph 12B, general inspection repairs. And when we teach the inspection classes, we talk about how sellers are obligated, once they receive the buyer's written notice of defective items, they're obligated to obtain estimates. Sometimes we're met with sort of wide-eyed look. Yep. I've never gotten an estimate before. I just fixed the items. So assuming buyer submits their written notice of defective inspection items, perhaps includes the inspection report so the seller could take a look at them, the seller has an obligation to, within 10 days, get those items estimated. So yep. obtain estimates for all the defective items defined under the contract, get those estimates.
So now we're assuming the estimates exceed the 1.5% or whatever
now,
they put
in. Right, all of that happened. We're assuming that that estimate exceeded 1.5% of the purchase price. So there's a couple options. Option one is seller can say, I agree to fix everything despite the cost exceeding 1.5% of the purchase price. Provides that in written notice to the buyer.
Within 10 days of receiving?
Within 5 days.
5 days.
And this is where the contract has a little bit of a glitch. Okay. The other option is buyer could say, seller, don't worry about it. Just fix up to 1.5% of the purchase price. I'll accept the remaining items as is. And the parties move forward to closing. If neither party says anything during that 5-day period, then either party can terminate. What's your problem with that?
Well, I'm not sure that the buyer here would know that not saying anything gives the seller the right to terminate here.
Correct.
Yeah. So there's kind of a gotcha here. So let's just say we have $500,000 place and we have buyer's inspections or defective inspection mm-hmm. items that exceed do the math in my head real quick. Is it $7,500?
I don't do math.
exceed 1.5%. Yeah. Yeah. And they send that over to the seller, mm-hmm. and the seller just doesn't say anything. The seller gets her estimates and they see that it's over. The seller doesn't say anything. And then all of a sudden on day six, the seller says, you know what? I want to terminate. My neighbor wants to buy this thing for $10,000 more. So peace out. So that's something that I think a lot of buyers would not be aware of. And it's kind of a got you. That being said, I think it does make sense from the standpoint of you guys agree. If you can't agree, either party can terminate. If you can't agree and not, well, they have, correct me if I'm wrong, they have the right yes. to terminate. That's the biggest issue that I have here. Yep. They have the right to terminate anytime prior to closing, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's the scary part. If they don't agree on how they're going to deal with the defective inspection items to the extent it's over that 1.5%, either party has the right to terminate up till the date of closing unless they do come to an agreement there. So.
Yes. So to recap, so if it's over 1.5% of the purchase price and seller does not say, I will fix everything no matter the cost, and in written notice to the buyer.
Or buyer doesn't say, just fix 1.5%.
Then, within 5 days after the receipt of the estimate, which is...
I like how you go, then.
No, it's...
Then either party can terminate the contract. And I think I was expecting there to be a timeline within which either party can terminate, and if they can't agree, then they can't agree. But the idea is we want the parties to agree because the seller is only obligated to repair up to 1.5% of the purchase price. Buyer should only have the expectation that the seller fix up to 1.5% of the purchase mm-hmm. price. If there is so much work that needs to be done that exceeds 1.5% of the purchase price, then seller's got to make a decision. Do I want to sell the property to this buyer and fix everything? Buyer's got to make the decision. Listen, I've already sunk in these costs into this property. Do I really want, am I willing to accept this property with these repairs, knowing that the seller only has to fix up to 1.5% of the purchase price? Or is either party going to remain silent? And then on day six, after the receipt of the last estimate, or the day of closing, when the buyer and seller are fighting over, well, I thought you were going to fix everything. Buyer seller says, no, I was only required to fix up to 1.5%. Then either party can terminate the contract. It's
crazy. So as a best practice, what do you...
Get the estimates. That's number one.
Okay.
Yes. Get the estimates.
And what about nobody saying anything? So we know, I mean, you get the estimates, right? It's greater than the 1.5%, mm-hmm. but we have no clarification on whether the buyer's willing to accept up to 1.5. And we have no clarification on whether or not the seller is going to do everything.
Yeah.
Right? Then what do?
We
not what you do as attorneys. Sure, what should the agents do?
There's an urgency here to get an agreement. Because if we don't get an agreement within 5 days, any party can terminate. On day six, if we don't get an agreement, it keeps on going. So there creates the urgency to have an agreement upon, mm-hmm. again, sellers obligated up to 1.5. So everything over 1.5, what are we dealing with? Buyer, are you taking it as is? Or seller, are you deciding to fix more than that? And there's just an urgency. Make it happen. And if you don't make it happen within those first 5 days, both parties are at risk of the other party terminating. So I think there is some balance there that both parties are treated mm-hmm. equally. Both parties, you know, can then terminate, and it does create the urgency to get that issue resolved on what each other, what the parties are going to be obligated mm-hmm. to, failure of which either party has the right to terminate at any point.
Is the agreement an amendment to the contract, or is it an email that can go back and forth, or how do you propose
It talks about written notice or written notice. Either the buyer mm-hmm. can give written notice that they agree to take, to have the seller only fix up to the 1.5%, or the seller gives written notice. So all we're dealing with is written notice here. We're not dealing with any amendments to the contract.
Unless it's something creative that's not one of these two options.
Sure.
So if it's option A, seller fixes everything, seller provides written notice, I would just take the language directly from the contract, have the seller preferably sign something, but perhaps write an email. I seller hereby provide written notice to buyer that I'm going to fix everything no matter the cost. If you're buyer, I hereby provide written notice that I want you to fix A, B, and C up to the 1.5%. I accept the remainder. Yeah. If it's a creative solution, not one of those two, amendment to contract.
Sure.
And I would say notwithstanding paragraph 12.
Maybe they want credits, different things like that. Sure.
Yeah.
The question is, mold and radon are not deemed defective items. Do you suggest using amendments for those?
I do.
Or Are there addendums for
carbon? There are addendums on the contract, or maybe they do.
There's not one for radon. There is one for mold. I think the radon's more like a disclosure if there is one. Yes, I have one. If you guys are interested, I'm happy to send one over. It's for mold and radon and drywall.
And then also there's always the alternative, which I really like, is the alternative being that have the right to inspect, right to terminate. If you're not under an as-is contract, therefore the buyer can get in there. If there's elevated mold, elevated radon, elevated whatever, they can always terminate within that due diligence period. So you're not have to worry about whether this mold counts as a mold that's elevated or whether what numbers are or different things like that. So
there are some mold and radon and drywall addenda that are circulating that I have been asked, well, what does it mean if this mold is elevated? So some of the language says, if there's a significant presence of mold, then seller shall.
What's significant?
What's significant? For some folks, a few spores is significant. So you need something sort of readily measurable. If it's, so the NABOR contract defines it as levels of mold on the interior as compared to the exterior of the dwelling. NABOR does carve out some allergenic mold, Penicillium aspergillus, but so the idea of having an addendum, if you're going to have an addendum addressing mold and radon and drywall, they should be very, very clear as to the party's responsibilities. So if there is X amount of mold, something measurable, then seller shall, at seller's expense, remediate the mold. Is that part of the 1.5%? Is that over and above 1.5%? So that should be clear in the addendum to contract. Same with radon. Seller has the seller doesn't in the contract have the obligation to do anything with respect to radon. So if you have an addendum to contract, identify the elevated levels of radon over 4 picocuries per liter, and seller shall mitigate, obtain permits if they need to obtain permits for the radon mitigation system. Have it retested at seller's expense prior to closing and close out that permit. And you need to be very, very specific what you're asking the seller to do. And again, is that above 1.5% of the purchase price? Do we want it included as part of the 1.5% of the purchase price general repair items?
This is my experience, at least when people are sensitive to mold or radon, they're very sensitive. Mm-hmm. And it's really difficult to find that number, that measurable, that makes sense to have an addendum to a contract, which, again, why I suggest that you see right to inspect, right to terminate, or the as-is contract for those particular clients who are sensitive to mold and or radon. Because a lot of the time, again, my experience is once they see a report back, if they don't like it, they don't want the house.
There's no change in their mind.
Yeah. By sending somebody in there to open up the windows for a few days to reduce a radon level or put fans or whatever they might end up doing to reduce those levels, they're generally just not comfortable with it. And now we're just going to have a continued fight because what they deem as mitigation and what might also, the seller might deem as mitigation, could be completely separate things. And I think it's best just to avoid it, give them the right to terminate if they have that issue, if they're very sensitive to it. So that's my thoughts with it.
We got another question.
All right.
I know.
We'll get to the email questions at the end. Go for it.
If the loan approval date was October 13th and the close date is October the 20th, and my buyer is getting a mortgage, and I don't do anything, can the seller cancel?
Tomorrow, the next day, and the day after that. Yes. Today is October 13th.
They have 3 days to do that.
The seller has 3 days. Unless the seller has waived the loan approval period or provided written notice to the seller, I have received loan approval from my lender. Seller has a 3-day period within which to terminate the contract. If the seller terminates, buyer gets the deposit back, buyer goes and moves on with another property, seller moves on with another purchaser.
Yep. So, and then the concern here is we have another gotcha here that maybe the buyer's loan approval period ends again on the 13th and they ask their agent, well, what do I do? Should I waive? Should I not waive? I mean, I don't know whether I'm going to get this loan or not. I have all this money out as a deposit. What should I do? And the concern is if you don't waive, then this seller just terminates In this example, we have a closing in, 5 days from now or 7 days from now. The seller terminates, and you have to call up your moving company and let them know that we're not moving this day. And that's just, to me, I would imagine, be the worst thing. That'd be the worst conversation to have with a buyer who thought they were moving in less than a week and now realize that they don't have a place to live.
So we do get this question. Why would a seller want to terminate? Especially right now, right?
Maybe they have a better offer someplace.
Maybe they're not comfortable that the buyer's actually going to get financing. Maybe the deposit is really low and they're like, listen, even if the buyer doesn't move forward, if the buyer defaults, all I get is $1,000. That's not really going to hold me over. I'd rather, take my chances and put the property back in the market.
So if the buyer sent in written notice of their waiving of the contingency or the loan approval period, does the seller still have the right to terminate or no?
So that cuts off the seller's right to terminate.
So the point is that agent has to do something. Or that seller is given the chance to be able to terminate in those 3 days.
I think you have to have the conversation and let's let the conversation not happen the day of, like the last day of the loan approval period. Step one is to calendar all the deadlines and make sure that the client is on their radar, because the client needs to have a conversation with their lender. Where are we in the loan process? Sure. Is this something that we are, is this happening? Is this something that we're comfortable with? I think sometimes it's challenging to time that loan approval period, because some sellers might only accept a 30-day loan approval period, but you've got a 60-day closing, and maybe the lenders put this file on the back burner and they're not that far along in the approval process. Yep. So another option for an agent would be to try to extend that loan approval, not necessarily in this scenario with the 13 days and yep. closing next week, but if you've got a lot of time left and the buyer still needs more time, the lender is saying, listen, buyer, you've submitted everything you need. We just can't give you approval at this time because, we're looking at the end of this month, not the end of next month. I would try to see if you can get an extension to that loan approval period. And depending...
Well, I think that's a great point, though. If we have a 60-day closing and a 30-day loan approval period, there's no possible way that you're going to really have any confidence. I just can't imagine that a buyer's going to have confidence that they're going to get their loan 30 days out here by the time that the approval's up. So I would make sure that loan approval period makes sense in comparison to the closing date itself.
But this is also part of a broader conversation about having what is in a reasonable amount to have for a buyer's deposit.
Absolutely. So I could not agree with you more on that. Yep.
Some buyers might say, listen, I'm only going to put $2,500 up, but I'm okay if I lose it. Not ideal, but I'm okay if I lose it because I want the chance to be able to see if I can get financing on this property. So a buyer who may not be certain as to whether they're going to be approved, may not be comfortable yet waiving the approval, but would say, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and waive because I really like this property. I'm going to take my chances. Yep. To me, it's worth losing $2,500 if I don't get approved.
And they can deal with any unforeseen risk of, maybe within those 30 days, they lose their job and then they can't get the loan approval. But they know it's only $2,500, so they know that they can absorb. They're willing to make that risk. They're willing to say, okay, I'm willing to risk this money in the event that I'm not able to get my loan.
Yeah. And that's the same with financing contingency, with really all kinds of contingencies, right? They're all about protecting the buyer's deposit. If X doesn't happen, buyer gets their deposit back, right? So the idea is if you have a buyer who has deposit money that they're willing to forego,
and it's not necessarily willing. They'd be comfortable. They understand the risk.
Yeah.
They understand the risk that if I don't do this, this money can go and I accept that risk at that point.
But I guarantee if you have a buyer, you put 20% down as their deposit amount and you go beyond, you blow past that loan approval period and the seller doesn't terminate, buyer doesn't get their loan approval ever, doesn't get their loan, and all of a sudden they've got, 20% of a lot of money down and it's deemed to be non-refundable under the contract, the buyer is going to be very, very upset. So I think the rule number one is we calendar all the deadlines and then have the conversation with the client. But it's not, a client will ask us, should I waive the approval period? I can't tell you whether you should waive. I can tell you what happens if you do, what happens if you don't, what the seller could do.
Yep. But and then back to James' point, then the next question is, why would the seller ever terminate? Well, we don't know why the seller would ever terminate. We can't... Most of the time in our experience, they don't. Could they? Yes. And why would they? I don't know. There could be,
they could change their mind.
Yeah. Yep.
They could just want to stay in their house. I should have, I don't want to sell this property anymore. I should have
It is a seller's market right now.
Yeah, there's a number of reasons why they can. We can't explain that to anybody.
But back to your hypothetical, if I represented the seller in this situation and we're October 13th and we're supposed to close next week, I would ask the seller, if you terminate, do you really think that you're going to have another buyer?
Of course.
A backup buyer. Cash transaction, zero inspections, zero contingencies at or greater purchase price. Factoring in also the carrying cost of the property.
Of course. Kit,
and that's a lot of pressure to put on the realtor, right? Like, I don't know. I think my realtor's right. I think that they can do it. But the reality is you might just want to wait out that week. Yep. See if the transaction will close. It doesn't usually make sense, especially that far along in the process, to terminate the contract in hopes of another buyer. And then the flip side is if they've got any hard costs out there, if they've got any estoppel fees that are out, if they've got any attorney's fees or whatever their hard costs are in the transaction, if they're starting over, well, they may be starting over with additional fees. So
we got 20 minutes left. You want to start looking at email questions?
Sure.
Go right ahead.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to skip that one. Oh, can I use the Farbar contract for my buyer's purchase in Collier County? Yes. Yes, you can.
Why are you laughing?
I just love it.
Of course you can.
Of course you can.
I know you can. I can. I'm sorry. Her response was great. Sorry.
However,
that doesn't mean the seller would accept the offer.
Correct.
On that contract.
And if the seller does accept the offer here in Collier County and you have a Farbar contract for a property that is a condo in an HOA, what do you do? What additional documents might you need to attach to your Farbar contract if you're purchasing in Collier County that you might not necessarily be accustomed to attaching to a sales contract? It's a condo and an HOA.
The disclosures.
Yes, yes. So you submit an offer on a Farbar contract. If you submit the offer and the forms that are in the MLS are on NABOR, so there's a NABOR HOA disclosure and there's no condo writer, you need to ask the seller to provide those documents to you. They may not be thrilled with the additional work, but if you're submitting a Farbar contract, two things: make sure that the appropriate writers are attached, and also make sure that the parties check the box as to who picks and pays for title.
So this is very important. If you're listing a property in Collier County and you have the NABOR HOA disclosures on the MLS, and then somebody gives you an offer on a Farbar contract, there's no problem with you accepting that offer. However, please know that the Farbar contract does not have certain language that's required for HOA disclosures. Statutorily required language that's not on the Farbar contract. It's in the Farbar addendums to the contract for HOA. It is on the NABOR contract. It's not on the NABOR addendums. So when you're dealing with a property that you have for an HOA, you receive a Farbar contract and it does not have the Farbar addendums, that is statutorily defective and the buyer could get out at any point if you're representing the seller. So as a listing agent, if you are accepting a Farbar contract and there's an HOA, make sure that you get Farbar HOA disclosures because it has that required document or required statutory language on there. That's a huge thing that is very, very easy to miss with really dire consequences. You miss that, the buyer can terminate at any point in time prior to closing. Absolutely. There's no gray area there. So make sure you're aware of that.
And unlike NABOR, Farbar does have a condo writer. So if you have a buyer, you're willing, you have the listing, you're accepting a Farbar contract, you must have a condo writer, which has also the statutorily required language for condos attached in that writer. So if the buyer doesn't receive that, in addition to not receiving those seven pieces of information, the articles, declaration, bylaws, and those kinds of documents, the buyer has the right to terminate by statute. That's not something that we can waive.
No waiver.
Cool.
Next.
All right. How can a buyer request repairs under a Farbar as is contract? Justin?
Request repairs under Farbar as is. They just talk to the agents. They have the agents figure out whether or not they're willing to, and if so, you have an amendment to the contract. That's the only way that we can. There's nothing in the contract itself, the as is contract, that contemplates seller being responsible for repairs. So if you want that contract to contemplate that, you have an addendum to the contract amendment, sorry, to the contract, mm-hmm. changing the terms, buyer shall. Seller shall repair and make it as clear as possible.
And if there's, I'm going to say, if there's any chance that the work can't be completed prior to closing, I would just say anytime. Include the what if. So seller shall repair the window prior to closing. If the window can't be repaired prior to closing, seller shall escrow, provide a credit to buyer at closing. Buyer can extend the closing date. You include the what ifs. And I would encourage you to consult an attorney to draft some of that language because...
Absolutely.
Yeah. But otherwise, Farber as is, similar to neighbor as is, amendment to contract is the document that you can have the parties. We already talked about the effective date. Let's skip that one. Okay. Who pays what association special assessments under FARBAR? So as Justin mentioned, the FARBAR riders are very, very important. Those documents will determine who pays which special assessments because there's a checkbox under the condo rider and the HOA rider that says, seller.
These are special assessments that are
homeowners association
that are related. They're certain as to what's owed, but not necessarily due yet because they're paid after closing. Is that correct? Or is we talking about all of them?
Oh, I will pull up the document. Bear with me just a second. Yep. I'm
able to. So when I think, Aaron's probably going to tell me I'm wrong in a second here, but I'll go ahead and go.
I'll let him keep talking.
Let me keep talking. I think what we're talking about here is special assessments that are not due yet, but are certain as to the amount and who owes them. And what happens is a lot of times you'll have special assessments that are paid over a 2-year period, maybe quarterly over a 2-year period, and the seller has not elected to pay them all at once. So who's responsible for those special assessments in that case? In the NABOR contract, there's no checkbox whatsoever. They're presuming that is a seller expense for seller to pay. The FARBAR contract actually has a checkbox where you can check on who is responsible for those assessments themselves.
Thank you.
No, tell me where I'm wrong.
No, that was good. Okay. That was good. Yep. Okay. So in Part B of the HOA disclosure under FARBAR, there's a paragraph 2, so paragraph B, if there's a levied or other special assessment that exists at the effective date or an assessment's levied after the effective date and prior to the closing date.
Yep.
And any such assessments may be paid in installments, and the seller pays all due before the closing date. And then they have a checkbox to see who pays after the closing date, whether it's buyer or seller. And if it's seller, pays it all in full, they'll pay it all in full at closing. And similarly, the condo rider has a provision. But I would caution folks on the condo rider. I've had a couple folks get tripped up on the condo rider language because it has not just levied special assessment, but also items that have been pending.
Sure.
And the condo rider defines pending as an item that was on the minutes or the agenda of the association within the last 12 months. So this is paragraph 3, subparagraph C under special assessments and proration. So there is an opportunity for a seller to say, hey, I heard 6 months ago they were talking about replacing the clubhouse roof. Put that on the condo rider disclosure because it is an opportunity for the seller to disclose it. If the seller doesn't disclose it and it is discovered that there was something that was discussed in the meeting minutes within the last 12 months prior to the effective date, that's the seller's responsibility to pay it all in full, even if it wasn't levied prior to the effective date.
And whether or not they actually knew about it. So meaning like I'm a seller, I don't even read the minutes. I never knew.
Got to be responsible for knowing.
Got it.
The minutes. And just to clarify, we're only talking about something that was pending prior to contract date, levied after contract date, prior to closing.
We are talking about something that has been on an item on the agenda, reported in the minutes within 12 months prior to the effective date. And then we say if there's something that's levied or pending as of the effective date, they're disclosed, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. If they exist as of the effective date and they have not been disclosed, even if it's pending again, meaning something that was discussed mm-hmm. on the meeting minutes, then the seller pays the item in full. If after the effective date, the association imposes a special assessment, which was not pending as of the effective date, then the seller pays all amounts due before closing and buyer pays all amounts due after closing. All that seems fair and reasonable.
Very clear, too.
Yes.
The FARBAR contract does a very good job with clarity on that specific issue.
Yes. Okay.
I've got a couple questions.
Oh, great. Go for it.
Who's responsible for providing the condo and HOA docs?
The seller.
Yes.
Okay. So it's always the seller. And here's the issue. If the seller doesn't provide, statutorily, the buyer has the right to terminate within 3 days of receiving that information. So it's absolutely a seller responsibility.
As opposed to whose? Listing agent's responsibility? Buyer's agent's responsibility?
It was an open there. I'm assuming, I don't know if they were going buyer, seller, but a seller pretty much covers it.
Yeah. It's the seller's responsibility.
100%.
How do you know if the condo has first right of refusal per the condo addendum?
Yep. You've got to ask the property management company. Ask the board. That's how you know. That's how I would know. I would look at an estoppel from a previous transaction and it will answer that question, but you've got to call. You've got to pick up and call or review the declaration. But usually it's easiest because I imagine property management companies by now have been receiving that question pretty regularly. It's rare for a condo to still have, at least in my world, it's rare for a condo to still have the right of first refusal. So I can only think of one condo association, actually. So anything else?
Nope.
No. All right. Let me go back to, okay. I think we might have covered this. If the seller is required to complete remedial action, let's say that the repairs were up to 1.5% of the purchase price, the seller is completing the remedial action but can't be completed prior to closing, then how do the parties determine what to escrow? So that's in paragraph 9 of the contract. So that's where we talk about who pays for what, buyer's expenses and seller's expenses. So it's paragraph 9, just under the percentage where the parties can negotiate what percentage interest or percentage of the purchase price that they want to require the repairs. So if seller is not able to meet the maintenance requirements, meaning something that was in working condition as of the effective date in the inspection period that is no longer working as of the closing date, that's a maintenance item. Or if the seller just was not able to repair one of the items that they were obligated to repair during the inspection, 125% of the estimated cost up to the repair limit shall be escrowed. 125%. That was the answer. That was a really long way to get to 125%. Okay. Then I think we just have just a couple more. Oh, this is a good question. Are funds to close required to be wired? If you ask a closing agent, they're going to say yes. All funds to close must be wired. So what the contract says, and this is at the bottom of page 1, the balance to close by wire transfer or other collected funds. And then it refers us to standard S as to what collected funds are. So the reason closing agents like wire transfers is because that is collected funds. The buyer can't cancel the wire mid-transmission. They're immediately available in the closing agent's account to disperse. If there is a check, well, it needs to be deposited and subject to collection or clearance by the bank. Someone had asked in the other part of this question is, how can you remove this requirement that, the parties submit the funds to close by wire? Cause I guess someone was really hesitant to actually wire their funds to close. And I think the reality is closing agents are going to want the funds to be wired.
Yep.
Or if there's a check, it's deposited and the parties wait until the closing agent's bank confirms that the funds are clear, but that could be a couple weeks.
Yeah. If we received a certified check though, cashier's check a week or so beforehand, that could be okay. But yeah.
Not on the day of closing.
Certainly. Oh, certainly not on the day of closing.
Yeah. All right. Oh, let's see. We already talked about this. Can the seller terminate the contract one day after the end of the loan approval period? Yes.
They absent waiver from the buyer.
Absent waiver or receipt of loan approval. Yeah. Oh, I think I hit the end of the questions.
I think. Any more questions?
This is good news. There are no other questions. We'll give folks a chance if they want to kind of slide right in here, but we are 7 minutes early. We always love to be courteous of everybody's time. I will use this as an opportunity if there's no questions, just to say, at Cottrell, Tyler, and Escrow, we love to put these webinars on. We are so grateful for Aaron and Justin to take the time out of their day, especially as everybody knows that's on here, it's busy right now, which is a good thing. But if you've never closed with Cottrell, Tyler, and Escrow, we would love the opportunity to one deal, let us show you how good we are, and let us try to impress you.
So I'll leave it at that. Though. Do we have time?
Do we have time for another question?
Yeah,
go ahead.
I'm interrupting you. So I think that's a great question. What happens if there's a casualty event under the fire-bar contract? What does the seller have to repair?
Are you asking me?
I am asking you. I think this is so important because it shows the difference between NABOR and fire-bar. One of the huge differences here.
Yes.
So I want to point that out here, that what is the seller responsible to repair under a casualty event? Hurricane comes and it knocks down a ton of trees and it knocks down the pool cage. What now is seller's responsibility up till closing?
Yes. So seller has the duty to maintain the property, including the landscaping, up through the closing date. Seller maintains the risk of loss and should also maintain insurance on their property through the closing date.
Yep.
If there's a force majeure event, so Farbar has a very robust force majeure event that includes not just damage, but also
when times can be extended.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. Synergy. So the short answer to his question is up to 1.5% of the purchase price.
Not to include any of the
landscaping.
So the landscape, their duty to repair the landscaping is only to remove the dead.
Yes.
And the dead landscaping, right?
Correct.
Dead stuff, right?
Yes. Correct.
Under Farbar, they never have the obligation to replant trees or flowers or any other type of shrubbery that might have died, or grass, whatever it might be.
Right.
Which is in stark contrast to the Farbar or the NABOR contract itself.
Right. So if our casualty loss is less than 1.5% of the purchase price, seller has a duty to restore the property. Mm-hmm. If the cost to restore exceeds 1.5% of the purchase price, buyer has the option to say, I will accept repairs up to 1.5% of the purchase price, accept the rest as is, and we move on. Or buyer has the option to terminate the contract if the repairs exceed 1.5% of the purchase price. And again, the idea is certainty. We like certainty. We want to know that the seller have to repair greater than the amount that the insurance will cover and that kind of thing.
So that's all. Yep. I thought it was good. That's all I got.
Well,
thank you, everybody.
That looks like a wonderful webinar. It looks like we'll be back in a couple of weeks. We don't have a topic yet, but we will be.
We don't know what we're doing yet.
No. It could be anything, Justin.
Oh, this is really exciting.
The world is our oyster.
If it's Q&As, I'm not going to be able to sleep either.
Yeah.
We appreciate everybody taking their time out of their day. Thank you so much. And again, thank you to Aaron and Justin. And we look forward to being back in a couple of weeks. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.